Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it is Friday, June 20th, and we have back with us this morning Congressman Marlon Stutzman from the great state of Indiana. And you will recall that he joined us earlier in the week, and then because of some cell tech issues, can you hear me now? We actually get to have him back on for a whole other segment. So that's actually okay with me. And we're very grateful, Congressman, that you are rejoining, because we didn't get into a couple of other topics that I wanted to address. But first, you were in the midst of talking about your Emergency Spending Accountability Act. So I wanted to go back to that first, and I'll let you tell our audience why that's so important.
Yeah, great to be with you again, Jenna, and thanks to our Hoosier cell signal in some spots, but we're good this morning. So appreciate you covering the Emergency Spending Accountability Act, because I think it's some of the most common sense legislation that Americans, we can all identify with, because we always have an emergency. You know, there's whether it's your little child that, you know, jumps off the kitchen table counter and breaks a leg and you have to go to the hospital and you got to pay that bill that you weren't expecting. Well, that, you know, obviously that happens at the federal government level as well. You know, we had this hurricane last year that went way up into, you know, it hits Florida and then it hits Georgia and North Carolina, and the damage was just incredible. You know, there's of course fires in California. There's always going to be an emergency, you know, sooner or later. And COVID, of course, was one of the biggest ones. But Congress always seems to take advantage of those situations. And you know, we think that there would be a rainy day fund somewhere that we would use to pay for emergencies. Well, we don't, which is sad. So we just add it to the credit card bill. And of the $27 trillion of debt that's publicly held out for the federal government, $12 trillion of that has been from emergency spending, so almost half of it. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel said back during the recession in 2009, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, that's a very bad approach to dealing with emergencies, because Congress has always overreacted, and then they pay for things in an emergency funding bill that is not even close to part of the emergency. I mean, they're paying for sprinkler systems on golf courses. I mean, it's just, that's the sort of thing that Americans, we all get so fed up with, is that we feel Congress takes advantage of us as taxpayers in a time when there is real need, and then they add all this other spending provisions that just add to the debt. And so the Emergency Spending Accountability Act requires Congress, we can do emergency spending, but it has to be paid back within 5 years, and that it needs to be considered like on budget. It can't be just allowed to be off budget, like a spending spree that all of a sudden happens during an emergency. And trying to get spending under control in Washington has been just so difficult. So I'm hoping this bill not only drives the conversation, but it actually is enacted at some point to control emergency spending.
Yeah, and this is so incredibly important. And as you're mentioning, you know, how recklessly legislatures and even executive branch officials have taken this emergency spending on both state and federal level, you know, well out of proportion. Previously, in the most recent example, has been all of the COVID emergency orders and all of this. It's so important to rein that in. And so I hope that this passes with a wide margin, and this really does make sense. And so I want to also move to getting your comments on the One Big Beautiful Bill, which which was very much in the news until the whole Iran controversy and all of that started. But this is still an ongoing debate in Congress. And now that the House has passed its version, it's gone to the Senate. The Senate is contemplating a couple of amendments that are really, I think, inexplicable maybe from Republicans. One of them is from Senator Tom Tillis, who's pushing an amendment that would strip Americans of the ability to bring justice against mega corporations, basically other woke institutions from legal accountability, and has marketed this bill, I think, deceptively as taxing, quote unquote, foreign litigation funding, when in reality, it subjects all litigation funders to a 41% levy. And the effect of this would be to drive away financing from conservatives that without litigation financing, which is almost impossible at scale for a lot of conservative causes even now, we wouldn't be able to bring these lawsuits against these giant woke corporations. So what's going on with Republicans in the Senate?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, I can tell you this. I mean, I'm a business guy. I'm a small business guy. We're family business. We focus primarily on agriculture and manufacturing. And, you know, we're large enough that, you know, we have to have lawyers and accountants, but we're still small enough that, you know, if a large corporation wanted to bury us in legal fees, they could do that. And so I understand the damage that, you know, frivolous lawsuits can do to a business. And I don't know that this is necessary, and this is not helping promote small business and also just conscience. You know, that's one of the things that oftentimes people want to shy away from politics because of ethics and conscience issues. People want to stay away, even some business sometimes. But we need Christians of faith and strong character to be in both of those arenas. And I love business, and I enjoy being in politics to fight for righteousness in both of those areas. And there's so many other people that are doing the same thing. And if there's a threat, you know, that all of a sudden we're going to be have to do business with a company, or that or they're coming after us because, or they won't do business with us because we have an opinion or a belief in a righteous position, and they're going to force us to do business. It's not right, and it's also easy for them to bury us under legal fees, if possible. So I think this is very dangerous. I think that, you know, we have to you know, let the justice system weed out, you know, some of these people that are looking for payouts. You know, the one thing that our founders, you know, created with three branches of government is that we all have the opportunity to be heard in court, but we shouldn't be forced to do that and just continue to be drug along with all legal fees. And we know big corporations, especially woke corporations, that's one of their causes, and it can pull people into a case that they don't want to be involved in.
Yeah, really well said, and I couldn't agree more. And hopefully, if the Senate is frankly stupid enough to pass this, that when it comes back to the House, the Republican conference in the House will be able to modify this or to, in some way, reject some of these things. How is that going to work? And do you think that there is stomach for the House to go against what Republicans in the Senate will have perhaps preferred?
Well, I think our best champion on this, and a reason why I'm so supportive of Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, you know, he's a constitutional lawyer. He has been part of so many different fights when it comes to religious freedom and to our constitutional rights and principles. I've got to believe that, I'm going to be talking to him about this, and I've got to believe that this is going to be kind of a deal breaker coming back to the House, that this is not one of the provisions that needs to be a part of the One Big Beautiful Bill, or any bill for that matter, because of the principles of it. So, you know, I'm going to be definitely talking with Speaker Mike Johnson and other leadership to say, look, this is not part of conservative principles. It's not a priority, frankly, and it shouldn't be a priority. I don't understand some of the things that the Senate is doing right now. Senator Hawley is suggesting we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. I don't think we, as a small business owner, again, we don't need those sort of things. We need to be focusing on what's really important, and that's making sure we get our budget back in line, that we focus on the border. And I tell you, President Trump has done such a good job of just keeping us focused on the top priorities, and that's making sure that America is strong here at home, that we have a strong military, that we have a strong economy. And, you know, even under the circumstances with Israel and Iran, that that we're being cautious but also standing with Israel, which I think is really important as well.
Yeah, and along those lines, and I'm speaking with Representative Marlon Stutzman out of Indiana's 3rd District there in Congress. There's been a lot of debate even among the conservative coalition and the MAGA base about interventionism, what the Trump administration and its view of supporting Israel in not allowing nuclear armament of Iran, and how a theological framework plays into this. I mean, it's very interesting to see that this isn't a debate among party lines. It's actually an in-house debate among the broader conservative coalition. How is this playing out? And as a Christian, what is your view on how we should look at whether or not we support Israel in this particular instance with Iran?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if you had the chance to see the Tucker Carlson, Senator Cruz interview.
Yes.
I thought that was such an unfortunate interview. And,
yes.
And look, I believe, you know, just as Senator Cruz said, the covenant that God made with Abraham back in Genesis is the principles for us to follow. But let's even take it out. Let's take it outside of that, you know, because let's say that it's even not biblically related, even though I believe that it is. But let's just simply look at it from this standpoint. What if Cuba was going to have a nuclear bomb? They were going to have a nuclear program. Would we, as Americans, would we stand for a nuclear Cuba? Absolutely not. I mean, with the Castro brothers down there, the dictatorships that we've seen in Cuba, the relationships that they have with them, we would not allow Cuba to have a nuclear bomb. And that was, you know, that was the Cold War. I mean, we can all should remember that we should learn lessons from that. Well, it's the same circumstances. What about Israel being a state the size of New Jersey, and we know the hatred that the Iranian regime, not necessarily the people of Iran, but the Iranian regime has hated and has said openly over and over again that they want death to Israel, death to America. And the fact that they want a nuclear bomb, and we know that they're building a nuclear bomb, is why we have to support Israel to stop what could be ultimate disaster for themselves as a country. They want to say this is a preemptive strike. It's not. I mean, let's go back to October 7th. They were attacked. Israel was attacked by Hamas off the Gaza Strip. They were also attacked by Hezbollah. They've been attacked by the Houthis. Well, who is funding all of these organizations? It is Iran. And so this is not a preemptive strike. It's a reaction to what has happened over the last several years of Iran using terrorist organizations to attack Israel while they develop a nuclear bomb to do what they ultimately want to do, and that's to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And we cannot allow it. It's not just America that should stand with Israel. It's the Saudis. It's the Turks. It should be anybody else in that region should say, you know what, we're not going to let Israel be the first to be held hostage or wiped away, but we're going to also make sure that we defend other greater parts of the Middle East from a nuclear Iran, because it's like giving a gangster a gun. He's going to shoot whoever he wants to shoot first, and then he's going to be able to go after anybody else that doesn't get in line. And that's why Israel needs to go in and do this. We need to stand with Israel. I would support President Trump using bunker buster bombs if that's what it took to make sure that we finished the job and supported Israel. But I also believe that greater parts of the world need to be standing with us as well.
Yeah, and so well said. And I think that in the greater context that our listeners, you know, have heard throughout this week, talking about the theology behind this, and you know what Senator Cruz, in my opinion, missed a really important point, that even though, yes, we believe the Abrahamic covenant is eternal, it hasn't yet been fulfilled, it's a continued promise.
Yeah,
that doesn't actually rationally really, it's not relevant to the contemplation here of Iran and
right.
getting a nuclear weapon. And so it's not that we're standing with Israel as a matter of covenantal theology. It's a matter of wisdom. And that, I think, was missed in the whole debate that you perfectly summed there, that even if another foreign nation didn't have a biblical framework for anything related to Israel, this is still a very plainly obvious issue to stand with Israel now. And when the Bible
yeah.
doesn't give us specific direction that prohibits or commands one direction or the other, it comes down to a wisdom issue. And the wisdom issue here, it seems very plainly, should be what the president and what hopefully the Republican members of Congress are doing in standing with Israel in this instance. So, you know, where
yeah.
would you, where do you draw the line or perhaps divide this in your policy framework between a theology that commands a certain policy and prescribes it versus a wisdom issue?
Yeah, no, that's a great way to frame it. And, you know, and I'll always stand with Israel from an Abrahamic covenant standpoint, but also, and you know what? I mean, it's easy to say, well, you know, Israel isn't following God's, you know, God's word the way that they should. Well, look, frankly, at America today, there's a lot of questions around us, and that's why we have to be engaged and in the arena to keep fighting for biblical principles in politics. We have to keep fighting for biblical principles in global and international diplomacy, and that's where why I believe it's important to be engaged here, because you know what? America has the strongest military. We're the strongest economy in the world. And when you have the strength, it's kind of like the verse that talks about to whom much is given, much is required. I know it's easy to say, you know what? We're just going to be America only. You know, we're tired of dealing with the messes around the world. Well, if we do that, we're going to let China, we're going to let Russia, we're going to let Iran, we're going to let all the bad actors go take over all the other neighborhoods, and then guess what? Then they're all going to gang up on us. And that's why it's important to have allies in these places. Europe right now, I tell you, I'm so disappointed with the European countries, because they're closer to Iran than what we are. And if North Korea had a nuclear capability, which they're working on, if Iran has nuclear capability, these are thugs. These are gangsters that will hold good people hostage. And so, you know, not only from a biblical standpoint, but from just a wisdom and common sense standpoint, to fight to protect good people is why we need to be involved supporting Israel. And like I said, it shouldn't be just Israel and America doing the dirty work. It should be European countries. It should be Middle Eastern countries that are also stopping Iran from having nuclear capability. And also, you know, just from a democracy standpoint, you know, everybody wants to, you know, defend democracy, you know, even though we're a constitutional republic here in the United States, with a democratic process. But, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Every other country over there is an authoritarian government. But, you know, as I've mentioned with you before, you know, after trips with Syria and to Saudi Arabia, these countries are coming towards the West because they do like peace and prosperity more than just a fighting and continuing to, you know, have no economy that works. So I think that stopping a nuclear Iran actually creates an environment for that part of the world to hopefully and you know, prayerfully move towards better principles and guidance there, rather than having a jihad and terrorist organizations training to not only take out Israel, but hurt the greater parts of the rest of the world.
Yeah, well said. Well, Congressman Marlon Stutzman, really appreciate you joining again on a Friday, and we'll have to have you back even more often. You're always welcome on the show, and thank you for your commitment and fidelity to biblical principles, wisdom issues, and being willing to share with our audience. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, a Florida federal judge has held Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer in contempt, civil contempt, for violating a court order related to a new state immigration law. So this judge had issued a preliminary injunction blocking the law's enforcement. This was duly ratified by the Florida state legislature, signed into law by Governor DeSantis. And somehow this judge thinks that a TRO was appropriate. But the AG sent a letter to law enforcement agencies stating he couldn't prevent them from enforcing the law, and this action was somehow deemed a violation of the injunction, leading to a contempt finding. And the AG said Tuesday in a post on X, quote, "If being held in contempt is what it costs to defend the rule of law and stand firmly behind President Trump's agenda on illegal immigration, so be it." Well, Attorney General James Uthmeyer joins us now. And where does this stand? And I applaud you for standing for the rule of law against rogue judges. What do you expect at the show cause hearing?
Well, you know, the contempt order has been issued. It was a civil contempt order, so I'm not behind bars. And she has, you know, issued a reporting requirement where every couple weeks I have to report on my compliance with the law. But this was a very unusual case. The first day of law school, students learn the scope of jurisdiction, separation of powers, the bounds of a court's authority. And in this case, there was not a single law enforcement agency sued, not one party before the court. So when the judge asked me to order all of state law enforcement to stand down, I don't have the authority to do that. And my oath to the Constitution, to Florida law, is paramount above everything else. So, you know, if she wants to hold me in contempt, that is a price I'm willing to pay to uphold my oath to the Florida Constitution and our state law. The interesting thing here is, you know, yeah, we had a state law that made being in Florida illegal, and she can say that that law is unlawful, but the federal government has actually delegated immigration enforcement authorities to all of our state law enforcement, and the federal law, you know, there's not any question about the validity of that. So we are going to continue being pedal to the metal, carrying out President Trump's agenda to enforce against illegal immigration with every resource we have, and the judge's ruling can't impact that.
Well, and I applaud you for that. And you're absolutely right that, you know, we learn in law school the chain of command, if you will, of what is lawful. And then when a judge steps outside of their actual jurisdiction to adjudicate an issue. And so are you planning to challenge the contempt as basically a contempt for an unlawful TRO to begin with?
Well, we are going to appeal her finding on the merits of the law itself. Haven't really fully reviewed the nature of the contempt order. I suspect, you know, we won't waste our time with that. I can tell her every 2 weeks that we're following the law, because we are following the law. There's no issue there. And the federal law authorities and delegations are going to give us all the resources and authorities we need to ensure that we are detaining and deporting illegal immigrants here in Florida. But the merits of the law, the state law, I mean, that is a longer view, you know, important issue. I do believe states should have the authority and autonomy to protect their borders. You know, historically, the courts have said this is a federal government prerogative and that it is up to the feds to enforce against illegal immigration. But when you're in a situation like we saw in the Obama and Biden administrations where the federal government doesn't want to carry out its duties, I believe states should have authority to protect their own borders.
Yeah, and that just seems to be a common sense. And, you know, I was asked in a separate interview talking about this and supporting you and what you posted on X. And I'm speaking with Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer about the civil contempt order, that typically conservatives will say, well, you know, we need to follow the rule of law. And if you don't like what a judge is ordering, or, you know, you don't like the Dobbs decision for the Supreme Court, for example, then, oh, well, we need to follow the law. But then when Republicans or conservatives, like in this instance, are going against a judge's order, and we applaud that, is that a double standard? And, you know, my response to that, well, was, of course not. We have to define what lawlessness actually is in context. But how do you respond to critics who say, well, wouldn't this lead to chaos if we can just pick and choose what judge's orders we follow or not?
Well, my response is, you know, just because a judge says something doesn't mean we should all bow down and honor it. You know, judges have obligations to the law themselves. And you see these judges across the country that are not willing to follow the law. And so leftist groups, they will forum shop and they will file suits in certain jurisdictions knowing that they're going to get a judge that's going to push politics and not law. And they'll get a ruling, you know, out of some jurisdiction in the middle of California, and that judge will apply that to the entire country. That is not what the founders would have wanted. It's not what they intended. And I think we're having a very healthy discussion in this country right now as we see judges, you know, impose political or legislative views on the executive branch. You know, when the president wants to get a terrorist out of the country and a district court judge says he doesn't have the constitutional authority to do that, I'm glad to see the executive branch pushing back, disagreeing, and carrying out what is indeed their constitutional authority. So nobody respects rule of law more than me, but if you have a judge that doesn't have the jurisdiction to issue an opinion in the first place, that's not something that I'm going to respect, you know, over my own views, my own constitutional obligations.
Yeah, really well said. And so with the left forum shopping, and I had a guest on a few weeks ago that said that, you know, even in the first couple of months of the Trump administration, already the left has filed nearly 300 lawsuits in various jurisdictions trying to simply thwart the president's agenda. I mean, all of this, of course, is lawfare, and it's selective, of course. And so with this particular judge in this instance, do you believe the purpose of the contempt order is punitive or more coercive? And what's the ultimate goal?
You know, I'm not going to get into the judge's motives. I can't tell you why she issued the order, but she clearly, you know, disagreed with my view. She clearly does not want Florida law enforcement to be detaining and deporting illegal immigrants. But the federal law is what it is. You have a president that's enforcing that law, and, you know, I'm proud to support him in any way I can. So we're going to continue enforcing the law of law, and we will carry out the Trump administration's agenda here in Florida.
And that's great. And so does this contempt order in your mind set a precedent for other perhaps rogue judges to pursue similar enforcement, and whether it is being misused for political ends or more coercive versus punitive? Would this set a precedent for other judges to pursue a similar track? And should Floridians in particular be concerned about expanded use of contempt authority?
I think it could set a precedent, and it's a dangerous one. You know, holding an attorney general, a statewide cabinet official in contempt of court is not something that should be, you know, viewed lightly. It is a big deal. I can take it. I'll handle it. You know, I'm a big believer in rule of law, and my duty is more important than punishments like this. But I would hate to see other officials start to cower and you know, diverge from their duties because of a judge's actions. So I do think it could create a precedent. I hope it does not. I hope that our actions, our situation down here in Florida, will be a wake-up call to officials across the country to realize that we do have a problem. And separation of powers should protect officials that are engaging in political decisions, and where judges do not have appropriate legal jurisdiction, they should stay in their lane.
Yeah. And final question, with this being overarchingly, you know, supporting President Trump's agenda, supporting the laws as it's and the policy, have you received any support or direct communication on this from the White House or Congress?
I've received some communication from congressional officials and executive branch officials. I think
People are supportive and appreciative for our stance down here. I think it's refreshing for a lot of people to see an official that is going to care more about the law than, you know, the possible or harm that could be inflicted. So down here, we'll take it. We're going to keep doing our job. We're going to keep following the law. And again, we're happy to support the federal government and its efforts to enforce rule of law and combat illegal immigration. It's important, and lives depend on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for what you're doing, Mr. Attorney General. As a Floridian myself, I can say that I appreciate so much your efforts, the whole DeSantis administration, and all of the freedom fighters that we have standing up in Florida. It's a really great role model, I think, in Florida for other conservative states. And we really hope that your example paves the path for other red states to stand up and do likewise. So thank you so much.
Of course. Happy to do it. It's an honor to serve. Thank you for having me. Always enjoy it.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. Well, we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, with Iran and Tucker v. Ted Cruz and all of the other things in the news, you may not have heard about the grooming gang scandal that The Economist is characterizing as a stain on the British state and involved a toxic combination, according to them, of victim blaming and misguided political correctness. So here to tell us all about this and the current state of affairs over in Britain is our good friend Raw Egg Nationalist. Who goes by that moniker, of course, who is the author of the book, The Eggs Benedict Option. And Raw Egg, thanks so much for joining. And what in the world is going on in Britain?
It's great to be back speaking with you, Jenna. Yeah, so what we've seen over the last couple of days is the release of the Casey Report, which was commissioned in January of this year by Prime Minister Keir Starmer under immense pressure. So this is a report into grooming gangs in the UK. I'm sure the listeners are vaguely familiar with this, at least. This is the ongoing phenomenon, groups of Pakistani Muslim men, mainly in the Midlands, so that's the middle of England, and the north, in towns and cities, deliberately grooming, abusing, raping, and even murdering white British girls, you know, sort of from the age of about 10 years onwards up to adulthood. This is a systematic thing that's been going on for decades and decades. We've known about it. There have been attempts to raise awareness and to do something about this problem for decades. It's been ignored. It's been swept under the carpet. But now, with this report, then what we're actually starting to see, I think, is the dam breaking. And the report doesn't actually really tell us anything we didn't know before. So it confirms that these grooming gangs are indeed predominantly Pakistani Muslim. It confirms the scale of the grooming and abuse that took place. So this has happened to tens of thousands of girls across the middle and the northern regions of England. It confirms that there was a cover-up, that there were institutional failings, but also individual failings as well. So this wasn't just a structural problem within, let's say, British government and the police. This was also about deliberate choices made by individuals to protect themselves, to ignore the problem because they thought that there wasn't any real political currency, because they didn't want to be perceived as being racist or Islamophobic or anything like that. But what I think is crucial about this is that this is now finally, after decades in which, you know, the problem was dismissed as a non-problem, as non-existent, as a far-right dog whistle or a sort of far-right talking point, now what we're actually seeing is an official recognition that, yes, this really has been happening and it really is as bad as was being said for decades. But there are all sorts of other things about it that we can get into as well. But that's kind of an overview of it, really. The grooming gangs exist. It's been taking place on a massive scale, and now we've got an official recognition of it in the UK, really for the first time.
Wow. And so what is the British government intending to do with this now? And now especially that is being raised by national media. I mean, there can't now at this point just be some sort of cover up.
Well, this is an interesting thing because there's still a lot of backside covering taking place. So one thing that the report explicitly says is that nobody should be prosecuted, that the government shouldn't go off, not necessarily the rapists and abusers, but nobody in government, in local government, in the police force, or in any kind of official function should be pursued for their failures, despite the fact that the report says there have been incredible failures by officialdom to recognize the problem and stop it. The report actually does say, you know, we shouldn't prosecute these people. So that's a major letdown. That's a major problem. But also, I mean, really what the report calls for is a national inquiry. It says, you know, we need to have a national inquiry in order to find out, you know, exactly what happened. And there are other recommendations, like there should be legislative changes, you know, so that older men having sex with teenage girls can't get away with it, you know, that it's that there are safeguards in place to prevent that sort of thing from happening. But despite the kind of the true horror of the phenomenon, and that it's really kind of been revealed by this report, and it's come into the full glare of the national and indeed the international spotlight. And it's worth remembering actually that this became an issue largely because of Elon Musk on Twitter. So Elon Musk, you know, he's come in for a lot of criticism recently for his erratic behavior and, you know, his spat with Trump and all of this kind of stuff. But actually, you know, he was absolutely key in raising this issue and making it so embarrassing and so basically impossible to ignore that actually, you know, the British government, Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, had to commission this report. So the British people actually owe Elon Musk, I think, a debt of gratitude for using Twitter, for using his social media platform as a way of speaking truth to power. He was talking to British politicians and saying to them, you should be ashamed. You know, you allow your young girls to be raped systematically by these grooming gangs. And that led to the report. So I think it's quite clear that there is going to be a cover up of sorts, and that although this is in a way a kind of full disclosure or something approaching a fuller disclosure of the problem, it doesn't mean, I think, that everybody who is responsible is going to be held responsible and punished, which is a big shame. So I think, you know, the public needs to maintain pressure on the government. I think the opposition, the Conservative Party, Reform under Nigel Farage, then they really need to press home the advantage now. This is a tremendous concession by Keir Starmer, having to commission this report and accept its findings, because, you know, the Labour government really didn't want, and the Conservative government before them actually didn't really want ever to have to address this problem because it is too painful. And it reveals, I think, the full extent of the failure of the multicultural project in Britain.
Yeah, and speaking of that, the multicultural project specifically, this is coming from or was posted on X by an account at GB Politics that is citing the National Crime Agency Operation Stovewood and those statistics about historical cases of child sexual abuse and exploitation. And they were able to provide the following data on the ethnicity of perpetrators within their investigation. And of the 323 designated suspects in Operation Stovewood, 64% were Pakistani compared to 22% of British, and then the rest of, you know, less than, you know, that comprises less than 10% otherwise were unknown, or, you know, 1% Slovakian. So the fact, though, that this basically accounts for 1 in 16 or so of Pakistani men in Britain, what does this tell you about the lack of assimilation into Western culture, understanding the worldview and the difference, of course, in religion? You know, there's a whole host of factors here, but the fact that, you know, this is basically 1 in 16, that seems really, really problematic just from this whole, you know, multicultural diversity, equity, and inclusion kind of framework.
Yes, and in fact, actually, now is probably a good time to point out another of the deficiencies of the report, which is actually that it largely shies away from talking about religion. It talks about ethnicity, and it talks about the fact that, you know, a vastly disproportionate number of the offenders are, in fact, Pakistani. But it doesn't actually make much mention of Islam. And, you know, we know that there are particular doctrines in Islam. There's one that's especially reprehensible called What the Right Hand Possesses, which is basically a diktat that, you know, you can take sex slaves as a Muslim man from among non-Muslim women. And that's been used, you know, I think, as a justification to justify the behavior of these men. You know, these girls are kuffars, they're infidels, they're white trash, you know, they're not deserving of any kind of moral consideration. So that's an interesting thing, actually, that religion doesn't get foregrounded in this report, and I think it should be, as well as ethnicity. But yeah, what does this say about the multicultural project? Well, it says fundamentally that it is an abject failure. You know, I mean, Pakistani Muslims have been in Britain since the end of the Second World War. You know, they started coming over after the Second World War to do factory jobs in the Midlands and the north of England. And what did they do? They formed their own enclaves, their own ethnic enclaves in cities like Bradford, Manchester, Leicester, and they kept to themselves. They never made any attempt whatsoever to integrate, and governments didn't attempt to force them to integrate. And so they didn't. And yeah, I mean, these are the fruits of 70 years of importing foreign groups who couldn't really be as any more alien than they are, and allowing them to retain their kind of alien status within the country, and actually to continue to see themselves as separate from the rest of the population. I mean, there's a related question, which is actually, well, could you make people like this integrate? And I don't actually think you could. And I think that probably should have been obvious from the beginning, that you can't just import people from Mirpur, which is a very poor region of Pakistan where a lot of these people come from. You can't just import these people, and even if you tried to educate them about British values and make them behave like British people, I'm not sure you could do it. But you certainly we shouldn't be surprised that after allowing them for decades to live like this in their own ethnic enclaves, and that they've basically been behaving like this and sort of like a kind of hostile alien population within the borders of England. And that is how they see themselves, as totally separate from white English people, from white English culture. and they look down and despise, look down on and despise the white people around them, and especially these young fatherless, usually, you know, sort of girls who are kind of already set on a bad path in life. They're poor, they don't have guidance, they don't have protection, and they were preyed upon like helpless animals by these Muslim gangs, and have been for decades. So I think it's an abject failure. It couldn't be a more stunning indictment of the failures of multiculturalism. And I mean, the thing is, I don't think it just goes on in the UK either. I think there are probably similar cases taking place actually across Europe and the Western world, wherever you get these ethnic enclaves, and particularly I think these Muslim groups from very, very poor places like Mirpur in Pakistan, which are extremely backward, have extremely backward sexual morality, and they're determined to maintain their customs, to maintain their way of life, and not to integrate.
Yeah, and that's such an important point, that when we talk about immigrants, even legal immigrants, obviously there's a context of illegal here in the United States, and that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, when the left is suggesting that multiculturalism is some high value ideal that we should strive for because, you know, we're the great melting pot in America, or whatever the West, including Europe, has suggested now from the far left, they're really diminishing the fact that so many of these people being imported are not looking to come to a Western nation to assimilate and to leave their former culture, way of life, belief systems, values behind, and adopt the views of the Western nation that they're coming into. I mean, even things like hygiene practices, for example. I mean, there was a article I was reading years ago, and I forget the publication, but was talking about how many different chopped fruits and vegetables that are sold at even just regular grocery stores are now contaminated just based on the hygiene of some of the workers in who deal with, you know, some of these products, and how that impacts overall the health and safety of, you know, some of these foods. I mean, even something, you know, that's that minimal comparatively with you know, the overall sexual ethic of a population or a diverse population, these things matter, and they need to be talked about, not because of, you know, the left screaming, you know, racism, or, you know, some of these other types of things, or, oh, well, you just, you know, we have the America or Western centric ethos. But it really does matter ultimately in terms of what society does a westernized culture, whether it's there in Great Britain or it's here in America, what is the standard for a moral and upright society? And we need to be able to have these conversations without just reverting to, well, you know, you must hate all people who aren't, you know, part of your culture, or, you know, something that simplistic. So where does the conversation need to go from here when we're dealing not just with the concepts of illegal immigration like the Trump administration currently, but with this whole idea from the left of multiculturalism and diversity as if that's virtuous, when we're recognizing and we're seeing actual harmful effects?
Yeah, I think that we finally need a dose of realism about the cultural compatibility of, you know, particular different cultures. It's one thing for a European country to receive immigration from another European country, and even that can be problematic. I mean, in Germany in the 1970s, for example, then large numbers of Italians ended up in Germany, migrating to Germany. And there were even problems there, you know, and Germans and Italians, you know, I mean, Germany and Italy are pretty close to each other. But even so, you know, there are significant enough cultural differences between the two populations for there to be friction. And but it's a whole other thing, you know, when you import a population from the other side of the planet, of different religion, you know, where cousin marriage is the dominant form of marriage. You know, in Pakistan, then you basically you're likely to marry your cousin, and then you're likely to have children who have rare genetic diseases. So I think what we need is we need some realism. I think we need to recognize that actually you can't just drag and drop populations of people from wherever on the globe into the US and expect them to be model US citizens, to expect them to assimilate. I mean, wherever you look in the US where this has happened, then you see the same thing with Minnesota, with the Somalis, wherever these people keep to themselves and it doesn't work.
Well said. Well, Raw Egg Nationalist, we'll have to have you back on soon to talk about the latest in the MAHA movement. I was going to ask you some stuff on that front, but this turned into more of an extended and I think important conversation over this that, the talking about the debate with President Trump and getting, sort of attacked for his comments on how the Somalis aren't assimilating. I mean, these are conversations that conservatives and Western culture in general needs to have, and we need to have very honestly. So thanks so much for your time this morning. And as always, listeners can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And don't forget to listen to On Demand for a fascinating discussion with Daniel Horowitz, AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.